Ayo, now you begin to feel something like a spirit, said my friend, seating himself upon a mossy bank, and motioning me to a seat beside him. You are becoming regenerated. Look at yourself, and you will perceive a change. You can also see, hear, and feel clearer and better. All your senses are awakened and quickened, because the spirit is beginning to work free from the crudities of materiality. It was indeed true. My senses did seem to be intensified tenfold. Distance lent no obstruction to my view. My vision appeared to be unlimited. I could perceive forms, radiant in angelic beauty, moving to and fro, towns and cities gleaming white in the sunlight where before my sight was bounded by the horizon, and I could see nothing but the limits of the beautiful valley, and no human being but our two selves. My hearing, too, was quickened, for sweet, harmonious sounds stole upon my ear, where before I had heard nothing. All my senses seemed to be trebly alive, and awakened to activity. My outer structure, too, had grown so clear and fair as to become almost transparent, while my garments had assumed a purity of appearance I had never noticed before. Ayo, you will soon be able to enter into and enjoy all the true pleasures of existence, resumed the poet. I, too, have passed under experiences and trials similar to your own, and though they were not induced by precisely the same cause, yet they were sufficiently severe to lead me to sympathize with and give you strength. He ceased, and my soul became too full of gratitude for utterance, perceiving which, he said, by and by, all these things will be explained to you, and you will thank the good Father for giving you these experiences, by which to develop and strengthen your spirit. But come, I must show you your work. Remain passive, and trust in me. Again I followed his bidding, and in a moment more we were gliding along the streets of an earthly town. Again I was in the precincts of old England, but material sights and sounds seemed farther away from me than ever before. Ayo, I'm going to take you, said my guide, to one who is noble and true to the stern duties of life, one who, in spite of trials and perplexities, of trouble and care, has remained faithful to the higher dictates of his inner spirit, who, reared in poverty, has yet carved out a name for himself, and by turning aside from the glittering allurements of life, has endeared himself to many hearts, a royal soul, a kingly mind, as yet in the physical body. I bring you to him, that from the example of his life, and the strength of his soul, you may learn your lesson, and draw encouragement to go on and do likewise. He ceased to speak, and instantly we were in an apartment which I recognized as the room of a thinker, a student, and a poet. There was but one occupant, a slight figure, bearing a lofty head and noble brow, with an earnest, intellectual cast of features. He was busy perusing a book, which, from the intentness of his gaze, I divined must have been a work requiring deep study. How calm and peaceful was the atmosphere of that place! The air was replete with quiet and rest. I shall leave you here, said my guide. Ayo, when we meet again, you will be the worker, and one who has found content and joy. Adieu. He was gone, and there, in the quiet sanctuary of the poet's study, in company with that loyal soul, whose earnest thought was to elevate humanity, in contemplation of his work, and drawing strength and encouragement from his fidelity to truth, and his desire to benefit mankind, I became strong and enduring, enabled to put away the enticing temptations of life, to expand my powers under the light of spirit development, and a desire was kindled in my soul that has never been quenched, a desire to be of use, to do good to others, to assist the needy, elevate the downtrodden, and enlighten and instruct those sitting in darkness. Sitting in the companionship of that noble mind, reading with him his works, listening to his songs of beauty, witnessing his dreams for the remission of human ills, painted as they were on the sensorium of his soul, in colors of gorgeous splendor, breathing in the perfume of his holiest aspirations, watching his struggles and triumphs, ere I became purified and purged of old crudities, and went out from that presence with a determination to do something for humanity, to be something in the great arena of life, and from that determination I have never strayed. Born of this desire, A, to do something for the good of humanity, A, there came to my soul a new strength unlike anything I had known before, and which enabled me to enter dens of vice in search of souls to aid without danger of contamination, or of falling a victim to temptation. Of my work in this direction I shall speak in a future chapter, but first I wish to tell you of a visit I have made to one of our brightest spirits, one whose songs are known and sung the wide world over. Chapter 24. A visit to Robert Burns. I had long been pressed and impressed to pay a visit to the spirit home of Robert Burns, Scotland's favoured child of song, where he extends the thorough hospitality of a genial heart, and where all kindred souls are welcomed with royal cordiality. Robert Burns, the 25th of January 1759 and the 21st of July 1796, also known familiarly as Rabbi Burns, A., was a Scottish poet and lyricist. He is widely regarded as the national poet of Scotland and is celebrated worldwide. He is the best known of the poets who have written in the Scots language, although much of his writing is in a light Scots dialect of English, accessible to an audience beyond Scotland. He also wrote in standard English, and in these writings his political or civil commentary is often at its bluntest. From Wiki, not from book. I had met Burns, drawing, not from book, upon many occasions since my entrance to the joys of spirit life. I had seen him in the public convocations of poets, had been with him at friendly gatherings where souls like his meet to enjoy the rich and varied productions of each other's minds. I had seen him in hall and bower, amid lofty and amid lowly scenes, and finally I had received a visit from him in my own private domain. But as yet I had never responded to his kindly, urgent invitations, nor to my own promptings, to return the visit. An opportunity at length presented itself for me to do so, and accordingly, with a friend, who wished me to travel leisurely as mortals do, and who accompanied me to point out the natural beauties and points of interest along our route, I set out with a joyful spirit, and anticipations of a rich treat, to visit the spirit home of Scotia's immortal bard. I will not weary you by descriptions of our journey. The time is coming when the localities and scenery of spirit life will be described to mortals by those who are fully competent to do so. At present, I will confine myself to the object of my journey, namely, the arrival at the spirit home of the poet. My companion and myself journeyed along, he interesting me on the way, by relating bits of history or incidents concerning places we passed, together with anecdotes of the people and their customs until we arrived at the entrance of a natural basin or valley, that lay like a great emerald between two ranges of towering mountains. Upon the right, the mighty pile reared its lofty head in solemn grandeur, the morning shadows resting upon it, only serving to deepen the impressiveness of its height and power. Its base of a dark brown hue supported the rugged pile, which deepened in color as it arose, until its apex presented the appearance of a gigantic amethyst, glittering beneath the light of morning in an indescribable purple splendor. Upon the left rose a range of polished stone, as white as sculptured marble, which gleamed and glistened in the sunlight like a mountain of frost work. Its numerous crags and peaks shone like so many spears of frozen snow, the rosy light resting upon its sparkling surface causing it to present an appearance at once marvelous and bewitching to the beholder. In the hollow formed by these mountain ranges nestled the valley I have mentioned, covered with a luxuriant growth of vegetation and verdure. Fields of ripening grain, blooming gardens, delighting the senses with their fragrance and beauty, waving trees, in all the glory of exuberant foliage, were to be seen in every direction, while the white cottages of the dwellers gleamed here and there, and in their delightful locality bore every indication of home comfort. The people whom we saw busy about their gardens, or caught glimpses of between the open doorways of their houses, appeared happy and contented. Their dress was simple, and seemingly worn for comfort, their countenances betokened peace and liberty. Songs of innocence and mirth arose upon the balmy air, mingling with the tones of children's merry laughter. In short, here was an Arcadia in real life, such as any poet might be proud to dream of, and to picture out to the delight of his fellow men. "Ayo, these," said my friend, "are the people who have gathered about Robbie Burns, as a flock of sheep gather around a beloved shepherd, or better, as a group of children gather about a beloved and venerated father, to listen to his advice, and follow his counsel, knowing it is for their good. A.O. Robert Burns has made these people what they are. They have come to spirit life one by one, worn and weary from the cares of earth, some of them even sin-sick and degraded from unnatural lives, led while in the body. He has gathered them together, taught them self-reliance, preached to them through the opening flower, the running stream, and the songs of birds. He has taught them to forget their cares, and to desire a nobler existence. He has set them at work to cultivate their gardens and build themselves homes. In doing this they have grown happy and found rest. Ayo, from him they have learned patience, self-restraint, and self-abnegation, a belief in the divinity of every spirit, and love for humanity. Ayo, some of these people, worn and broken down, came to him of themselves. They had heard of Burns while on earth, had read his words of sympathy, of love and tenderness, knew that he had sinned and suffered, and that with all he had faith in man. Through the great desire of their souls to see him, they were drawn to his presence, and his great, kindly heart, understanding their needs, spoke to them words of cheer, which gave relief and strength. A.O. others he himself found by the wayside, sunk in misery and degradation, he held to them the helping hand, kindled in their breasts contrition for uncommitted, which brought a desire to do better and be better. He found their loved and loving ones for them, and all reverence him with love and blessing. The children abiding here are little waifs cast off from earth, who have known no tender care before their spirit birth. Here they are cared for and educated by those capable of giving instruction to opening minds. A group of merry children, laughing and shouting in glee, dashed by us as my companion ceased speaking, their faces radiant with joy and happiness. We paused at the entrance of a magnificent garden, whose limits extended far and wide. The well-kept walks, the superb parterres of blooming flowers, the shrubs raising their graceful branches as if conscious of their beauty, the grand old trees rearing their mighty heads, and casting grateful shadows, the pond at the further end, gleaming and glittering in the sunlight, rustic seats scattered here and there, banks of velvet-like richness, bright with their vivid hue of emerald green, all betokened this place to be the property of one who loved nature, and was a willing worker in beautifying and adorning her productions. This immense garden was not enclosed from the public way, except by a low hedge of evergreens, whose tops were tufted with delicate, creamy-hued, fragrant blossoms, reminding me forcibly of our own native hawthorn. No gate barred the entranceway, it was open to the free admittance of all. At the farther end of the principal walk arose a plain, unpretentious dwelling, its white walls gleaming with an appearance of purity and peace. So far had we come up the valley that this cottage appeared to us to rest at the base of the purple-crested mountain, like a bird's nest securely fastened upon a rugged rock. "Ayo here," said my guide, "you have the home of Robert Burns. I will now leave you to his care." Ere he could proceed, a form issued from the open doorway of the house, and hastened down the path to meet us. That beaming countenance, those kindly eyes, and warm, cordial hands extended to greet us, that commanding, yet unassuming figure, clothed in simple, rustic garb, could belong to no man in God's universe but Robert Burns. It needed no honeyed speech, no formal words of greeting, no conventionalities, to tell us we were welcome. The spirit of our host overflowed with hospitality, and his soul beamed with all the fervor of his joy at meeting us. Oh, the pleasure that enwrapped my being when I first entered the sanctuary of that good man's great heart, and felt that we were congenial companions. No constraint, no conventional formalities with him, all was freedom and perfect ease. My guide pleaded necessities of business as an excuse for leaving me alone with my host, and as we both preferred to roam in his great treasure garden to entering the house, and feeling refreshed and strong in spirit, as though I had just partaken of food, which was true, as I had been feeding my soul all the way on the many delights I had encountered. We turned down a bypath, and I began to examine the rare plants and elegant shrubbery of the place, my host displaying and explaining his treasures as we went. "I'm surprised," said I, "at your wealth of luxuriant bloom, and the beauty as well as the delicacy of the perfume of these plants. They surpass everything I have yet seen. You must give them a great deal of attention."
"Oh well, lad," replied my companion, "it's not that so much. I look after them every day, of course, give them water and just the right degree of light, and trim and train them when there's muckle need, but I think it's adaptability to surroundings that makes them fine. I love them, everyone, and it's real pleasure to care for them." And it was with unfeigned fondness that he bent over a rare stock of geraniums, and lifted a magnificent bloom to my view. We wandered along, chatting about this shrub and that plant, the proper treatment of this stock, and the right degree of culture for that variety. Nature and time had made him a thorough floriculturist. It was the spiritual refining of that love of nature, manifested in the farmer boy, using the plough spade, and weaving songs of richest beauty over his work. Again we paused, this time by the side of a parterre of the most beautiful garden lilies I ever beheld. The creamy, cup-shaped blossoms, which crowned the slender stems, rose tall and straight from a low mass of deep, dark, and glossy leafage, while the regal flowers, with their tints of snowy richness, flecked with tiny bars of golden hue, emitted a fragrance of the most exquisite yet subtle of delicate odors. There were dozens upon dozens of these royal blossoms, filling the air with their rich perfume, and inviting the honeybee to visit them in his search for sweets. As I paused to admire this magnificent group of beauties, mentally likening them to a bevy of pure-souled, white-robed angels, and to drink in the full richness and glory of the scene spread out before me, there came, wafted upon the scent-laden air, a strain of sweetest music, such as I have often heard in spirit, but which is never produced by any but highly cultivated or advanced souls, accompanied in this instance by a female voice in singing, and such singing as so full of melody, of expressive tenderness, with a rich undercurrent of harmony mortal tongue or pen is inadequate to describe. I looked at my companion inquiringly. Said he, "It is my Highland Mary, the sainted soul who passed on before me, and who has made me what I am. This patch of lilies is her especial pride. I have named them for her, and call them Athas nor Mary. We shall soon be with her, and you will see her for yourself." I was delighted at the prospect of meeting Highland Mary, which delight of course he perceived. We moved on past beds of beautiful verdure and bloom of every hue, and arrived at the lake, a superb sheet of water, clear as crystal, and extending over a large area, its margin laid with tiny, white cobblestones, presenting a neat, pretty appearance. A fairy-like boat was moored at a landing place, upon the side of which I observed painted a large, thrifty-looking thistle. A rustic bridge extended across the lake, over which we passed. At the farther side were a number of tiny arbors, around and above which twined and clung flowering vines, some of which were very familiar to me. Toward the nearest of these flower-wreathed pavilions my companion turned. The sound of singing had ceased, but through the swinging leaflets of the vines I could perceive the white drapery of female garments. In a moment more we were in the presence of that sweet, long-loved, immortalized Highland Mary, and well might Robert Burns have mourned her loss, and well might the poet soul have sung his sweetest song to Mary in heaven. The features of this sainted maiden were almost transparent, a halo of celestial beauty shone about her form as she moved, her beautiful eyes emitted a radiance that must have been dazzling to those not fitted to enter her sphere of purity, her bonny hair rippled down her back in waves of golden light. The beauty of mind, the purity of an innocent heart, the tenderness of soul, expressing itself in sympathy toward the weak and erring, combined with traces of experience in human suffering, manifested themselves in the chastened refinement of that lovely countenance, and the sphere of purity surrounding that angelic being. I stood before her abashed and humbled, but a moment more, the sweet voice of Burns Mary bade me welcome, and I was made to feel at home. Years of experience in the higher life had been of inestimable value to that maiden. She had had the teaching of highly developed spirits, and the beauty, brilliancy and grace of a cultured mind, that was accustomed to deep thinking, were plainly discernible in her remarks. I was content to be a listener, and to drink deeply of the living waters of truth that flowed from the gifted mind of my host, and from the tender, loving soul of his companion. But our stay in the pavilion was short. I would fain have lingered far longer, but the lady, on hospitable thoughts intent, after the fashion of woman everywhere, seemed anxious that I should be conducted to the house and have refreshments. My protestations were overruled, and we accordingly started for the abode, not by the way my host and I had come, but on the outer side of the garden. On our journey I made a new discovery. Mary had turned to me previously, and said, "I would like you to see my aviary, the place where I keep my pets, in fact, their shelter house," and soon I understood to what she referred. We were approaching a thicket of bushes. I recognized firs, gorse, and hawthorn among them. Passing through this thicket, we entered an extension of the garden, still laid out in beds of beautiful flowers. A grove of trees, in the center of which a pretty fountain sent up its jets of crystal water, arrested my attention, and beyond that, the sparkling roof of a large glass building. The bushes and trees resounded with the melody issuing from the gaily feathered throats of numerous songsters, of every size and variety. It was a bird kingdom upon a small scale. As we entered, the birds surrounded us, alighting upon the heads and shoulders of my companions, but, while they flew close to and around me, only one, a tiny white warbler, would alight upon my person. This perched upon my shoulder, and chirped and nodded as pert as possible. We entered the glass building. Within were planted shrubs and trees, some of them bearing fruit, others seeds. There were no cages, but I observed numerous nests attached to the bushes and trees. The floor was the natural earth, the sun shone warmly, and all was beautiful. There were no doors, but here and there entranceways, always open for the convenience of the feathered denizens of the place, who came and went of their pleasure. A stream of water gushed from a rock, and gurgled and plashed over a heap of stones. This was the birdhouse belonging to the estate, and the especial pride of Highland Mary. We tarried a few moments, and then continued our way to the house, which we soon reached. How different the scene! A plain, unpretentious, white dwelling, with no attempt at ornamentation, the sun shining down upon it, fully displaying all its simplicity. Within was the same, neat and cheerful, suggestive of comfort and repose, but nothing finical, nothing tawdry, no glitter, no display. There was no covering to the cool, white floors, excepting here and there a rug or mat of green rushes. The walls of the apartment into which I was ushered were draped with a snowy gossamer-like fabric, the chairs round, wide, and comfortable, the tables oval and plain. Here we were served with refreshments, a fruit of various kinds, sweet cake formed of honey and the meat of nuts, and sparkling water. Afterward I entered the sitting room of Spirit Mary. Here the walls were draped with blue silken stuffs, the furnishings were more elaborate and elegant than the other parts of the house, and all arranged in exquisite taste. My hostess entertained us with her tender, soulful singing, striking a harp-shaped instrument, which sent forth a delicious accompaniment to the song. In Mary's apartment, or boudoir, I observed a pot of primroses in full bloom, the yellow petals of the flowers recalling old familiar scenes of earth, and the sight of these flowers recalled to me also that they were the only ones I had noticed within the dwelling. This seemed singular to me. With all that wealth of bloom and fragrance without, it would only be natural to find every room adorned with slips and cuttings. Of course the drift of my thought was perceived. Burns smiled, but Mary enlightened me. "Robbie will never pluck a flower," said she, "for his own use. He does not think it right to bring them out of their native elements, and deprive them of life on the stalk. He thinks they are hurt when they are culled. He also leaves them all out to be enjoyed by anyone who comes along, but I have seen him often break the flowers for some wee lassie, or poor laddie, who looks at them wistfully. He knows by that they had none too many flowers and pleasures on earth. I looked at Burns. His kindly face lighted up with intelligence and spirit beauty, every feature aglow with goodness, and every member of his body filled with energy, with suppressed power, with concentrated activity, now in abeyance, but ready to spring forth for the well-being of another, a he who had risen above all earthly passions through his great love for and faith in humanity. And I thought how characteristic of the man is this abode of peace and rest, a the home, the shrine of his faith and love, a plain, simple, yet full of cheer and interest, a no glitter nor show, a like his own kindly heart, unpretentious, full of kindness, overflowing with interest in God, nature, and man. Without, all is beauty and fragrance, yet the natural productions of life, refined by care and cultivation, typical of the rich, the beautiful expressions of his poet soul, a refined through love, cultured through sympathy, manifested in sweetest heart songs, exemplified in those peaceful homes I had seen, whose inmates rise up and call him blessed. Characteristic of the soul is this, who would cull a flower to give a poor heart cheer, yet who will pluck none for his own use, to deprive them of natural life, a who, when he had inadvertently uprooted the tiny, wayside flower with his ploughshare, immortalized the humble daisy with air, thou bonny crimson-tipped flower, thou'st met me in an evil hour, for I'm uncrush among the stower thy slender stem, to spare thee now we're past my power, thou bonny gem. Still the same good man, gentle alike to man and beastie, tender to wayside flower and weed. Another apartment in the home of the people's bard is fitted up as a study or library. Here are collected volumes by the true poets and philosophers of all ages. Some are prototypes of what are or what have been on earth, others are the outward productions of minds, grand and glorious in their brilliancy of thought, radiant with exquisite imagery, glowing with descriptive genius, or sweet and pathetic appeals to the tenderest emotions of the soul, through their simple, home-like, heartfelt tales of life and love, and which have never been heard by mortals. But you must not for a moment suppose Robert Burns to be dependent upon books for intellectual enjoyment, or for the attainment of knowledge. The soul is limitless in its resources, boundless in its capacity for expansion, and that spirit who earnestly desires to gain knowledge, finds a power developing within the mind which enables him or her to comprehend the fields of learning continually opening before the vision, while facilities and opportunities are afforded by which an honest seeker may grasp the truth as it appears before him. Could you but faintly realize the scope of the spirit, its perfect freedom, its power and right to travel where it listeth, you would understand that in the high life we have but to earnestly desire to be in the presence of any great soul, in order to gain pleasure and profit from the gems of love, beauty, and wisdom which fall upon receptive minds from those great repositories of thought, and, lo, we are there, drinking in great and mighty truths from those who are above us in grandeur of thought, beauty of expression, and sweetness of spirit. Robert Burns is by no means confined to his books, but, as he informed me, though his brightest thoughts are drawn from the life of nature, or the hearts of humanity, he loves to gather about him all the expressions of the sweet, soulful, noblest ideals which others have produced. Much, that by force of circumstances, he was deprived of on earth is his now, all that will tend to ennoble and elevate his soul, which was denied him here, he finds on the other shore. Why he does not ornament his home with those adornments that denote rank and wealth to the external eye is because his soul loathed the arrogance, and learned to despise the superciliousness which he found in the hearts, often stamped on the faces and shown in the mien, of many wealthy aristocratic personages he met with while on earth. He is nature's child to the core of his being, and no glittering pageantry will adorn his heart and home, as well attempt to gild the rose, and paint the lily, to add to their beauty. Together, he and I went forth into the smiling valley. A low burn wended its way beneath the shade of waving trees, close down to the mountain base. Thither we directed our steps, for he wished to show me, with a sort of fatherly pride, the great plumy bunches of purple heather tufting the sides of the gigantic hills.